This is the Rise Up See Red podcast, all about the Arizona Cardinals and the NFL, featuring insider and outsider perspectives. Enjoy the best hour of Cardinals talk on the web. Now here are your hosts, Jess Root and Seth Cox.
Hello, Arizona Cardinals fans, and welcome to the latest edition of the Rise Up See Red podcast. This is your host, Jess Root from CardsWire.com, the USA Today NFL Wire site covering your Arizona Cardinals. And as always, I've got Seth Cox from RevengeTheBirds.com, SB Nation's Arizona Cardinals site. And this is episode 295. This is the first of our 2020 off-season shows. I guess technically it's the 2021 off-season. The Cardinal season ended in Week 17 with their loss to the Rams as we closed out the season last week with our show, our end-of-season show, and we begin our off-season series of shows. Seth, how was playoff weekend not having to do any Cardinals work? I mean, bittersweet. It's, for me, bittersweet, as always, because it's work, but dadgummit, wouldn't have been nice to have the Cardinals there.
Yeah, it would have been nice. I mean, obviously, it makes the weekend for us easier. But, I mean, we would rather be out there and you know, enjoying watching the Cardinals win or lose, continue to play. It always, you know, sucks when the season's over and when you're basically done. And yeah. So to not see them out there, I mean, maybe they get run off the field by the Seahawks, but I think they could have had a competitive game that really gave them a chance to win in advance. And but I will say this, after this weekend, you have to feel a lot better about the butt kicking they got the week before.
Yeah, right. There's that. And we're going to talk about that with what's coming up is in our show. But the one thing that I lament is you look at the fact how the Bears played against the Saints. Had the Cardinals picked up one stupid win they should have won, that would have been them in the seventh seed, and then they could have gotten their butts kicked by the Saints. But had they been able to beat the Rams, then they would have been the ones playing Seattle, and Seattle looked very beatable. So we're actually going to talk a little bit about the playoffs. We won't get super in-depth. We'll give our thoughts, our impressions of what we saw from the playoffs in the first round of the wild card games. We're going to talk about it, and then we're going to jump right into the off-season things. The biggest off-season questions. There have been some reported coaching moves on the Cardinals staff. We'll talk about the biggest needs, and then a little bit of the guys that they have signed to futures deals, and then a little bit from the national championship game. We won't get big into free agency or the Cardinals' individual free agents yet. We feel that that's basically a show in and of itself. We don't want to make this a 3-hour show. We gotta spread out the content pretty much. So let's go ahead and get started, Seth. Let's talk about initial reactions to what you saw over Wild Card Weekend. What did you take away from the weekend?
I think it was, well, I always kind of try to look at everything from a Arizona Cardinals perspective. And the first thing I took away is that the Cardinals are not as close as we had hoped from a talent perspective. And I think that was obvious the second half of the season, when DeAndre Hopkins started to slow down a little bit in his production because of, you know, how teams were covering him and making sure he wasn't the guy that beat them. But you look at the teams that won, and, you know, you look at the Bills, and Stephon Diggs is obviously phenomenal. He beat out, you know, Hopkins for one of the all-pro spots. But in that game, they were able to really, you know, spread the ball around. They had a lot of different guys affect the game in a positive manner. You know, you had obviously Diggs with 128 yards, but you had Gabriel Davis with 85 yards. You had Cole Beasley with 57 yards and 7 catches. When you're able to kind of spread the ball around, and that makes a huge difference. You look at, you know, the Saints, and you look at their defense, and, you know, we've talked a lot about the Cardinals maybe lacking in just kind of health in that department. But you look at their starting defense, and you know, who plays on their defense in terms of snaps. And I mean, Malcolm Jenkins is older. And by the way, I know the Bears offense stinks. So, you know, but Malcolm Jenkins is older. Cam Jordan is a good player, but he's not, you know, he's not the Cam Jordan he was a couple years ago. You know, he's 30, almost 32. Chandler product, by the way. So, you know, you look at it, and he's not quite the guy he was, but their scheme and their athleticism puts them in a position to be successful. And again, I get it was the Bears, so, you know, take it with a grain of salt. But you look at the Browns win. You've got the idea of a team that has, you know, really kind of scraped and clawed to get to where they are, and then, you know, put it all together, and they do it in a bevy of ways. Obviously, you know, Pittsburgh shot themselves in the foot quite a bit, but the Browns, you know, have taken their time getting their team to the right mixture of players and coaches and, you know, finding the right guys. And I think that's a big part of the deal. And it's kind of funny because their offense really took off when maybe their single best player, Odell Beckham Jr., went down. You know, Tampa Bay is not a team I don't think you can really look at, because Tom Brady is just, you know, obviously a different guy than anybody else in the league. But that Washington team, you know, you look at it, they've got four first-round picks on their defensive line. They don't have much talent on offense, but their defense does enough to keep them in games. And their offensive line's not bad either. And then Baltimore, you know, before we get to the NFC West face-off, Baltimore, you see a team that has continued to find a way to be physical, to reload on the defensive side of the ball. I mean, you look at their defensive front, and they're made up of mostly guys that they've brought in off the street. I mean, Derek Wolf, Calais Campbell, you know, and the guys that they, you know, Yannick Ngakoue, and the guys that they've drafted have been on day two and three. So again, you're talking about a philosophy that's there more than anything else. And I think that's one of the things that, you know, when you look at it from the Cardinals' perspective, you say, and you and I've talked about this quite a bit, what is the philosophy? What is this team's philosophical backbone from a football perspective? Because they haven't been an air raid team. They were running the ball extremely well last year. In the first half of the season, when Kyler Murray was healthy, they ran the ball extremely well. But as soon as Kyler got hurt and wasn't able to run, they became a team that didn't know how to run the football, or at least run it efficiently. Defensively, I don't want this to come across as Vance Joseph bashing, but they don't have a ton of talent that was healthy by the end of the season, and the talent that they did have didn't seem to mesh well together. You know, Isaiah Simmons still wasn't playing a ton of snaps. Byron Murphy's snap counts were, you know, would ebb and flow. I mean, those are the young guys. Obviously, Jalen Thompson was injured for most of the season, so you give that a pass. But outside of Buda Baker, who was the young guy that they kind of brought along and developed this year defensively? And that's the thing. It doesn't feel like they did that. And so when you look at it from, you know, a Cardinals-centric point of view, I didn't get that it just seems like the Cardinals, from a philosophical standpoint, aren't close to a lot of these teams and who they are and what they want to be.
Maybe. The one thing that I took away from that is that had they somehow been able to beat the Rams, that, man, they'd been playing Seattle, and Seattle looked pretty beatable. But I will say that, oh my gosh, what was with the Rams? Because that defense looks championship capable, and how they end up falling apart there, and how they lose to the Jets, like how I get how Seattle beat them, because Seattle somehow does that. But then in the playoffs, to just really take control of everything and do that with, it's almost like, you know, it kind of feels like one, the defense took the Brandon Staley took that defense took it a level up after Wade Phillips left, but then offensively, it's like Sean McVay, and I guess for some reason maybe that Doug Peterson thing a couple years ago when they won the Super Bowl, and Doug Peterson had to kind of change how he did things because of Nick Foles. When McVay needed to do it, and he put together a game plan for a John Wolford, and even when Wolford gets hurt, a banged up Jared Goff means he didn't cut it loose as much and sort of limited him to kind of game management status in some ways, and you saw a better result. Now, what we also saw is Cam Akers being what some of us liked about him as a prospect coming out of school, and we're like, yep, there's that. And suddenly the NFC West looks like 49ers are one thing, but the Rams and the Seahawks still are something to deal with. Had the Cardinals managed to sneak in as the number 7 seed, yeah, probably wouldn't have been one and done, and it probably wouldn't have been all that pretty, because there's something about that Saints offense that really gives the Cardinals defense problems. And from, I guess, what we said earlier this year, in general, like a 3-4 attacking front, like what the Cardinals run, like what the Buccaneers run, and if you probably look at it, same as what Chicago runs at that. And it just really causes problems. Now, you look on the AFC side of things with the Bills, and you're like, how did the Cardinals beat this team? And mind you, that was a game the Cardinals had control of for most of the game, and then Buffalo got that clutch drive because the Cardinals just couldn't offensively do anything in the fourth quarter and then managed to pull out. So you're like, how did they win that game? Because the Bills were rolling out. Phillip Rivers had a heck of a game. It was a fun weekend. And here's the other thing that I really liked. You know, I kind of like having a 7th playoff team and having a wild card, you know, super wild card with 3 games on Saturday and 3 games on Sunday. Yeah, I really liked that.
Yeah, 2 full days is a lot of fun, and it makes it, you know, it makes it an event. You've got basically 9 hours of football from, you know, Arizona time, 11 a.m. until, probably more than probably closer to 10 hours of football time, you know, and it's just, it's a lot of fun, and it makes it enjoyable, and it's kind of something to base your days around and really just sit back and relax. Obviously, it was a little easier for us because we didn't have to cover anything, which, you know, changes things a little bit.
It does. But I actually happen to be, you know, listening in the car for most of the weekend as my wife and I took our daughter up to college for the spring semester. And so going up to Northern Utah and back, it was spending a lot of time with the phone on. Now, I was driving and I was being safe, but I had it on my TV app. So I was the game was on my phone, like on the TV, but it was a nice way to handle the driving, the 11 hours of driving each way that it ended up being. So yeah, that was a heck of a lot of fun. And it's interesting the dynamic that you're seeing, at least on the quarterback side of things, but because you've got your in the NFC, you've got your old guys. You've got your legends with Tom Brady and Drew Brees and Aaron Rodgers and then the Rams. And then you've got the Rams. And in the AFC, obviously you've got Patrick Mahomes, you've got Lamar Jackson. Then you've got Josh Allen. So here you've got these young stars and well, it's an AFC. They're all young studs that you've got, because you've got Baker, you've got Patrick, you've got Lamar, and you've got Josh Allen. And then in the NFC, you've got the legends.
Well, and I think that's kind of my favorite, little nugget of information is that Baker Mayfield's the oldest quarterback in the AFC playoffs.
Right?
And it's like, wait, wasn't he just the first overall pick 3 years ago? So, you know, it makes it enjoyable, and it's, you know, a funny thing. It's good to see. And somebody tweeted it out. I think it was Justice Mosqueda. And you know, I agree with it. He's like, it's funny that for the first time in forever, the AFC is the more exciting offensive football division or conference. You know, you look at kind of the history and just the way football has been, it's typically been, you know, NFC teams that are a little more wide open and enjoyable may not be the right word, but, you know, more fun to watch from that perspective. And so to see it be the AFC now with all these young, talented quarterbacks is, you know, it's definitely a different perspective.
Right. Coming next on the Rise of Sierra podcast, the best of Cardinals talk on the way. Let's move on and start with the Cardinals. We're going to discuss what the biggest questions are for the Cardinals entering this offseason. That's coming next on Rise of Sea Red. We're back on the Rise of Sea Red podcast, the best of Cardinals talk on the web. The Cardinals have a number, like, we could say, as disappointing as it was at the end, overall, it was a step in the right direction. But just like they did at last offseason, they do enter this offseason with a chunk load of questions. And let's talk about those. Seth, for you, what is big question number one as the Cardinals face this coming offseason?
I think the biggest question is, what is their plan in or to help Cliff Kingsbury? You know, it's interesting that I don't know if it was, you know, have they said, I guess they'll probably never say, but who was kind of making the decision to let go of David Ray? And you know, I don't know if Tom Clement necessarily was on, it was his decision to retire, or if he, you know, was one of those, hey, maybe it's time to retire type of suggestions. And I'm not speculating. I honestly don't know. So that makes it interesting, because is this potentially Cliff saying, hey, I've done it your way. It hasn't worked like we wanted it to. Let me have a chance to do it my way. Because I am interested in that and how they what that means for Cliff and his decisions or what he does next.
For me, one of the big questions, actually, I think the number one question for me entering this offseason isn't so much about what they do, handle the coaching staff. We're going to talk a little bit about what the coaching moves, at least the ones reported, have been. And that is how the Cardinals maneuver the cap this offseason. We know the cap is likely going to drop. It might not drop as much as anticipated, because if they get the 17th game set for 2021, with the media kicker, that should alleviate some of the issues and maybe be able to keep it near flat. But nonetheless, the Cardinals, as of right now, are until the offseason in not a great place in the cap. So it's going to be interesting with the fact that we know that they are still a step or two away. That after their start of the season and how they ended, it became clear that they were close, but they weren't there yet. And so they do need another step or two forward. And they how they're going to manage the cap with the number of needs that they have.
Yeah, and it's interesting because you look at the way that they've built this team, and I mean this is a long conversation to have, so to try to sum it up, they haven't really built well in terms of contracts. We've talked about Steve Keim's penchant for kicking the can down the road, whether it's Terrell Suggs or Sam Bradford or heck, Devondre Campbell's contract where there's, what, $4 million on the salary cap next season. And so what are they going to be able to do with these contracts coming up? Because, you know, obviously they're about, what, $25 million right now projected?
Something like that. I haven't looked at the big cap numbers so far simply because we're going to do that for another show. But it's not ideal, especially with the number of players that they have under contract. Like you counted it up. So they signed 20 guys to future deals, and they have, what I by my count, 33 guys whose contracts are expiring. So if you just go by the 53 on their roster plus a handful, they're returning 25 to 30 guys from this roster.
Yeah, and so you look at it, and they've got two big decisions to make at hugely expensive positions in Hassan Reddick and Patrick Peterson. And they're also both big time positions of need. So the question becomes, you know, like you said, how do they manipulate and manage and maneuver around those kind of two glaring needs with, you know, not a ton of money to work with?
For me, another big question for the Cardinals is, this is one that we have every year, but I think this is the real one because I don't think he comes. This will be the first year that I would be honestly surprised if he does return, and that is what the Cardinals look at post Larry Fitzgerald. And honestly, it's going to be odd because it could be a post Larry Fitzgerald and Patrick Peterson Cardinals team in 2021. But mainly, does Larry come back, but less so, because I think signs point towards his retiring for a number of reasons. You know, they've had that security blanket at quarterback forever. His numbers were the lowest of his career. He obviously contracted COVID. He missed the last game of the year. That's how hurt he was. You can tell that this kind of felt like, see, in 2015 and 2014. I'll say more 2014 and 2015, where his legs, he was dinged up at the end of the year and it really took his toll. And now since of the COVID protocols, we weren't able to see in the locker room, we weren't able to see just how much it affected his walking around or how achy he looked or appeared. But what's this team going to look like offensively without Larry Fitzgerald? Because you always, like now with Hopkins, so you have a number one. But with Fitzgerald, you always had a guaranteed solid number two guy. And I know they've tried to move on from him. They know what he could do, and Cliff wants him back. but it means moving on from him. And I mean, that $11.5 million that he costs to bring back every year probably could be used better. But at the same time, looking at that receiver room, even with Larry Fitzgerald, is going to be scary not looking at Larry Fitzgerald in there.
Yeah, and it'll be, you know, one of those situations where I think, you know, it'll be more difficult when it actually finally kind of happens and takes place than anything else. Because, you know, like you said, we're still not sure, but it definitely feels a little different this offseason than it has in off seasons past.
What other questions do you see the Cardinals facing? What major questions this offseason? Not necessarily positions, but big questions facing the team.
I think the last one is, you know, how are or is this truly a make or break year for Cliff and Kime? And that's, you know, I think we'll be able to see some of that based on what they do this offseason and maybe how desperate they are, or based on the moves they make. But, you know, it's been, you know, an interesting way to get here. So how does it kind of finish up is, I guess, my question. Is this, you know, is this the year that they put the pressure on Steve Kime, or is this just another offseason where he's, you know, he knows he's got maybe another year in his back pocket, barring obviously catastrophe where they're, you know, picking first again. But, you know, or is this a team that will, you know, be playing basically for their head coach and their GM throughout the season?
And for me, mine's slightly related to it. It's similar to that. And for me, it is, how do the Cardinals as an organization, as team, and as a team with Cliff Kingsbury as coach and Kyler Murray at quarterback, handle what now I believe in year three of this coaching and this regime, as we like to say, this year should be actual pressure. There are greater expectations this year, and I think entering 2021, it becomes pressure. Not necessarily hot seat pressure, but when Cliff Kingsbury came on, there were few expectations other than, hey, let's be better than the disaster. That even if they didn't improve in wins by much, which they didn't, 2 wins better in 2019, to not look like the dumpster fire like they did in 2018. 2020, there was the expectation of progress. They far exceeded that to start the season, but there was no pressure at all. Now that we've as fans have seen what the team could look like at that 5-2 and 6-3 start, not only does that up the level of expectation, but since they should have been and arguably should have been a playoff team this year, I think 2021 now comes with pressure. Not necessarily, not just expectations, but the pressure to win, because they were already. Now, I will readily admit that the fans right now who are calling for Cliff Kingsbury to be fired, that's crazy talk, and it's dumb, and there's not, it's unfounded based on just the overall look of things, if you look at the big picture. That said, I believe if the Cardinals cannot handle the expectation, because we've seen Arizona sports team crumble in the face of expectations almost every single time there's been any sort of pressure at all. You know, dating to the Diamondbacks, their 2007 season was fun. Their 2008 season, not good. 2011, it was a surprise. They went to the playoffs. 2012, when they were expected to, not good. The Cardinals, they built up 2015. That was a surprise. It's special 2016 when they were talking Super Bowl. And it's just every single time that a team in Arizona seems to have lofty expectations and not just, hey, we believe this is going to be good, but now we expect it and there's pressure to do it, they crumble. And I'm interested to see how this team handles the level expectation. There was a level of expectation entering this year, but it was more hope than expectation, in my opinion. So that is my other thing. How do they handle the pressure of expectations for 2021?
Well, I think the other thing is, and you know, this can kind of be the end of this topic, but it, you know, you don't want it to be this way, but it does feel slightly like the Phoenix Suns team. And I can't remember which one it was. It might have been the Earl Watson team, but it could have been the one after that, where they started out that season looking like a team that was going to make the playoffs and fighting for the playoffs and, you know, all that. And then they kind of
probably it.
Okay. And then they stumbled right, you know, down the stretch and all of a sudden couldn't get out of their own way. And that's the question. And I know you guys wrote about it is, you know, is Cliff able to finish? Is he going to be a guy that's able to kind of see it through, or is he the guy that gets you to a spot and then you have to, you know, go find the guy to take you to the next step? I think, you know, obviously the other thing is you have to be really careful. And I wrote about this for tomorrow, whether it's, you know, we're talking about the Suns or whether it's in the NFL, you have to be very careful with, well, you're not meeting expectations, so we're going to let you go. Moves, because those can, you know, sometimes being a team that's at 500 is okay while you search for that elusive, you know, final piece. You look at a team like Philadelphia. Obviously, they got it with Doug Peterson, but you know, after they fired Andy Reid, who kind of, you know, always seemed to come up a bit short, they you know, battled and fought trying to get back to respectability. You look at the Cincinnati Bengals and Marvin Lewis had them in the playoffs what, every couple of years?
Well, and then wasn't it five straight years four or five straight years in a row when Andy Dalton first started his career? They just never won it. I mean, they haven't won a playoff game since 1990. But
right, and so you look at it and you go, all right, well we've got to find the guy that's going to take us to the next step. And it's like, okay, I don't disagree with you, but who is that guy? And have you identified them? You know. You obviously, this is a huge, you know, leap, but you need to find the guy that goes from, you know, Bill Parcells to Bill Belichick. Obviously, finding the greatest coach in NFL history is really difficult. But if you're going to move on from a guy, you don't want to move on from Jason Garrett to go to Mike McCarthy and then be a laughingstock, right?
It worked out for the Cardinals to go from Wisenhunt to Arians, although it was a different situation because Wisenhunt's last year was a disaster. That said, they had been, you know, they took a step up. So Denny Green set the stage, built the foundation for Wisenhunt, who then turned it around. They kind of faltered when they couldn't find the quarterback after Kurt Warner. And then Bruce Arians comes in and then lifts them up. And then, well, we haven't reached, you know, respectability ever since then.
Well, and that's what it is, you know, and I, you know, I'm one of the biggest and loudest guys against, you know, probably against Arians, but I never was, you know, the guy that was saying it's time to move on and fire him because you didn't have a plan in place. And so him retiring was, you know, unfortunate because it's just one of those things. It's you, I get that you look at certain teams and you go, well, they did it, so why can't we? But there is still this idea that it's the Cardinals. And it's not, you know, the Bill Bidwell Cardinals, but there are still some, you know, oh, it's the Arizona Cardinals ideas out there. And I mean, you look at the coaching search when Kingsbury was hired, and a couple of their first choices just flat out said, no thanks, I'm not interested. Mike Munchak, I believe, was one of them. And then Eric Bieniemy of the Kansas City Chiefs, both of them.
And McCarthy, too.
And McCarthy, all of them declined interviews. So it wasn't like, it's not like the Cardinals, I saw today, it was somebody said, you know, stop wasting time, go get Lincoln Riley. Oh, okay, yeah, because it's that simple. You know, you can lure Lincoln Riley, who's one of the five highest paid coaches in college football, has basically a job for life, making a ton of money, and is basically a demigod in Oklahoma, to Arizona, who is one of the least successful pro sports franchises in all of North American sports history. Yeah, sure.
And let's be honest, there is now coaching in the pros and coaching in college are two very different things. Cliff Kingsbury loves the pros. He is so glad to be out of the college game to deal with boosters and to deal with recruiting. He didn't like any of that. You get the vibe now. But at the same time, the type of control coaches have over players at the college level is not the same type of control you have at the pro level. And someone like Lincoln Riley, who gets the recruits, who gets gobs of money. I mean, think about it. They'd almost have to pay him. Unless he's you know, dead set on a pro job, you're going to have to pay him almost John Gruden money to get him away from college.
And in more than John Gruden money, yes, you're correct, but more than John Gruden money, you're going to have to give him John Gruden security. You're going to have to say, hey, we're going to give you 8 years, you know, $80 million or $88 million. Like, oh, we won't fire you for 8 years, because that's the big thing that people don't get in the NFL. I mean, and you and I have kind of poo-pooed this from the start, but we're still talking about it, so it's worth saying. Cliff Kingsbury has improved the Cardinals over his first two seasons, and we're legitimately talking about whether or not he deserves to be fired. Now, there's no traction towards it, obviously, and this is just, you know, a podcast, and you and I are having a discussion, but it's still a conversation that's being had. Lincoln Riley's never even, I mean, he doesn't even know what those words mean. And so, again, you're talking about like, hey, just go get this guy. Oh, okay, yeah, because it's, I mean, you look at Jacksonville. They've got the number one pick in the NFL draft. They have the best salary cap situation in the entire NFL. And they have some decent pieces. I wouldn't say that they're, you know, great, but they've got some nice pieces on hand. And they're allegedly talking about $10+ million a year for Urban Meyer, and he's still going, not sure that's what I want to do. Now, I'm not saying the Cardinals are Jacksonville, and I don't mean to insult Jacksonville in any way, shape, or form. But, again, this isn't Dallas. This isn't, you know, one of those prime jobs where people just run and are willing to come here. And so unless you're really, really certain you're getting the next Sean McDermott or Sean Payton, or, you know, or one of these, you know, Mike Tomlin types, where they're going to be here for a while. I just don't see what the point is of rushing or trying to push this regime out. Like you said, obviously disaster is one thing, but if they continue to improve, even if it's slow, it's at least improvement and it's going in the right direction.
Absolutely. Coming next on the Rise Up Sea Red Podcast, the best hour of Cardinals talk on the web. Let's move on. Talk about their biggest needs of the offseason. So we've talked the questions. Now what are the areas in which they need to make their moves this offseason? That's coming up next on Rise Up Sea Red. We're back on the Rise Up Sea Red Podcast, the best hour of Cardinals talk on the web. Biggest needs that the Cardinals have. They've got a number of them. Let's start on the offensive side of the ball. Obviously, quarterback, not an issue. And I would dare say they really don't even need to address the backup quarterback. I'm not worried about that. You know, number one for me has to be, what do they do at receiver? Do they go draft another big guy? Do they sign one? Or do they simply expect more out of Christian Kirk, Keyshawn Johnson, and Andy Isabella? But you can't, especially if Larry Fitzgerald is retiring, you've got to have something better than what they've had behind Hopkins, right?
Yeah, I think that's a big thing, and I think you're right. That's one of the biggest question marks going on this offseason is, what does your receiver room look like heading into 2021? I think if you have one of Kirk or Isabella step up into and turn into a really good three, potential low end two, you're fine. And obviously you're not going to cut any of those guys because they're all on rookie deals and they're, and like we said earlier, 33 guys on the roster. You can't afford to cut guys making sub $2 million to go sign veterans for more than $2 million. but you know, what do they do? Where do they go? Is it a draft pick? Is it a, you know, potential Robbie Anderson type, where you're willing to pay $10-12 million? You know, can you get a veteran type like an Emmanuel Sanders? And I'm not saying Emmanuel Sanders, I'm just kind of throwing out names, player, you know, types, you know, like a Marvin Jones type of player where they're reliable. They're, you know, going to give you more than what you've gotten from the guys you have and give these and run it back one more time with those guys, assuming obviously Fitz is gone. If Fitz comes back, I think it buys you the opportunity to draft, whether it's day one or day two. You know, obviously the day two picks haven't turned out the way you'd hoped. So maybe you look at day one, but you can't force anything. I mean, if one of the top guys isn't there, you can't just say, well, we need one, so let's go get one. But, you know, if for some reason that Jalen Waddle, one of the Alabama kids, is there, you know, maybe that's the pick. You know, I haven't really looked at too many other day one guys. I know, you know, people have mentioned Rashad Bateman. I know people like Chris Olev from Ohio State as well. So, I mean, there's definitely guys that you can look at, but I think this is a deep enough draft in the wide receiver prospects where if you're comfortable with who, you know, your veteran with a Fitzgerald, you can get a guy on day two that maybe answers that call. If you lose Fitzgerald, I think it has to be a priority in free agency, because I don't think you can go in with Hop and then Kirk and Isabella and Johnson. And that's not a shot at those guys. It's just that they haven't done enough
Yeah, they haven't proven enough to trust them.
But then it also makes it really difficult to bring in a young guy, because that's a lot of pressure on a young receiver, basically saying like, hey, we need you to be the number two this season. like that's your role. Good luck. So,
you know, I think it's the running back position is a position of need. And it depends on how they view Chase Edmonds, whether you need to bring back Kenyon Drake, whether you draft a running back high, or if you go with a capable veteran who can produce. So we'll talk more about it. Kind of a guy, you know, I'll throw the name out there. A guy like Carlos Hyde, I think, fits in terms of skill set, production, career to be a nice 1-2 with Chase Edmonds, whether they want to bring back Kenyon Drake or not. We'll talk about that on another show. But I think they're going to have to address the running back position, because they use Drake as their bell cow, and now they don't have one unless they're ready to just anoint Chase as that guy.
Well, and I think, I mean, obviously we'll learn a little bit more this offseason. But I think if they want to go forward with the kind of lead back philosophy, who gets a lot of touches, I do think that they need to put a concerted effort. Obviously, finding a Derrick Henry type is, you know, or Christian McCaffrey or Dalvin Cook, those are incredibly difficult things to do. So, you know, I'm just putting names out there. I'm not saying that you have to find that level of a player, but you probably need to find that type of running back who can sustain 250 to 300 touches in a season. And you know, I'm not sure that's Edmonds. I think Edmonds is a very good player that has a lot of potential, but he also has shown that he cannot hold up to the grind of being the lead back. And I think you can't go into a season with him as the lead guy. I think if you bring in a Carlos Hyde, you can get by with him and maybe an Eno Benjamin or Jonathan Ward, as well as Edmonds. But if you're looking for a more complete, you know, every down back, this off season is probably not the one to find it in free agency, but it could be had in the draft.
How pressing do you see the offensive line this off season? Because it feels like they're play dip down the stretch. But if you look at the personnel, it looks like they kind of have things lined up. Whether that's Mason Cole at center or Lamont Gilliard. They like Justin Murray. They signed him, and it appears they have him lined up to be starter at right guard. They still got Justin Pugh. DJ Humphreys obviously signed for a while. Kelvin Beachum was great. But with Josh Jones and Marcus Gilbert coming back, Marcus Gilbert will come back after this season, and probably Josh Jones will enter the year as the potential starter. They might give him another year, but I think they planned on him being the starter for 2021, as long as he showed during the year, the practice, that what they wanted him to do. So I don't know how much of a pressing need the offensive line is, because I think they kind of have a plan for that. Whether they should upgrade or not, I think they already have a plan in place for it.
Well, and the thing is with the offensive line, and this is literally for every team in the NFL, is you can always improve. The problem is you don't always have that opportunity. And, you know, we talked about it. This team, just from a structure standpoint, doesn't have a ton of talent. And I'm not saying they're not a talented team. What I'm saying is they physically don't have a ton of players. You know, so they have some good players. They have some pieces, but they also they need more players. And so when you're talking about 33 players and eight of them, I believe, are offensive linemen, that's a large swath. I get that you could cut Justin Pugh and find, you know, a guy that is probably cheaper and save some money, but
is he going to be any better at the right? But when you combine the new money and the dead money, essentially,
right? And so that's what the question becomes: is, you know, is the juice worth the squeeze in getting rid of Pugh for, you know, a guy, whether it be a rookie or whatever else. So if you're comfortable with who do they have there, they have you know, Justin Murray, who you and I think they plan on starting with the money they paid him, and gosh, who's the other guy that they don't have? Max is an under contract, right?
No, Max is going to be a free agent. JR is going to be a free agent, and so they've got Mason Cole and Lamont, got Mason Cole, they've got Josh Jones, and Marcus Gilbert comes back on the 1 year deal that he would have had this year.
Yeah, so whether it's Gilbert or not Gilbert, Jones or Lamont or Cole, if you feel like one of those guys can be as good as Pugh, then I guess you can cut Pugh, save the money, and then maybe draft a guy to develop. But I think, like you said, Jones is, they think that he's going to be their right tackle. Obviously, we know that they've got DJ Humphreys penciled in pinned in as their left tackle for the next 2 years at least. So that's, you know, that's what the question becomes is again, moving on from on the offensive line, as much as we'd all like to say, hey, go get offensive linemen, it's, you know, it's more complicated than that when you look at the rest of the roster.
You know, at tight end, they only have Max Williams coming back in terms of contract.
And he's always hurt. He's very, very good. I think he's one of the more important players on offense, especially when you look at how bad the run game is when he's not in there.
But at the same time, you look at it's not a high pressing because the particular skill set that you need for that position, you can get a good blocking guy. You can get them all over the place. They just don't offer that flexibility. And if I don't know how critical the tight end is in the passing game, unless you have a guy like Dan Arnold, because it would just give Cliff Kingsbury an excuse to use more Chase Edmonds or more receivers. So I don't consider tight end a need because I don't think it's a position they need to invest a lot of money into or much money into.
Yeah, and I would agree with that. I mean, unless you think that a guy like, you know, throwing a name out there, Kyle Pitts, the young tight end from Florida, is a, you know, true game breaker. I don't see it as a glaring need for this team when they have so many others.
You know, defensively, I think you have to stare that cornerback position as you have to do something there because you got Byron Murphy.
Yeah, and I mean, technically you have Robert Alford, and somebody made a great point, and I think it was Andy Kwong, one of the writers for my site, wrote that, you know, with Alford, it's actually probably a good idea just to bring him back, to cut him or basically give him the option of like, hey, you're more than welcome to come back, but we're lowering your salary because you haven't played at all.
Down.
So, but I mean, honestly, it couldn't hurt, right? Because you really, I mean,
he's as reliable as, say, Jonathan Joseph or Drake Kirkpatrick, right?
And you just, I mean, it's not hyperbole. You literally have nobody else on your roster after Byron Murphy. So, I mean, what's the worst that can happen? He gets hurt again. Okay, so if you reduce his salary and you know, give him a vet minimum type of deal, is it really the biggest deal in the world? I don't think so. I think it'd be smart just to have him. I mean, because who knows? Maybe he can play well. Maybe he's healthy for a season, and it helps you while you, you know, look for the right fit at corner to go with Murphy.
Right. So, honestly, I'm going to say this. Call me crazy. In terms of what they need. Now, there's a lot of things they can do, but what things that they need, cornerback is basically it. You've got the guys like Hassan Reddick and Marcus Golden entering free agency, but I think you've got a good mix of defensive linemen with Jordan Phillips coming back. You've got the young guys. You've got Zach Allen. So you've got some guys. So that I don't think it's a big need at linebacker. You look okay. Like, it looks like they're in a good position there. So it doesn't necessarily mean they need to address it. And the edge, you could. But when you return Chandler Jones and Devon Kennard, you feel solid with that starting lineup, especially the way they both with the season started. And at safety, you've got guys that you like there. So in terms of defense, well, you have things you can do. But other than cornerback, I don't see any really pressing needs.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, I think you could add one more edge player.
You can always do that. That's the thing at that position. You can never have enough cover guys, and you can never have enough guys that could pass the rush the passer.
I think it also depends on what they end up doing with Dennis Gardeck, because he's a restricted free agent. I'm assuming they're going to tender him.
I don't know. Tendering, that's going to be like $2.5 million. Yeah, maybe they do it. But you know, I go back. Jerron Brown, he tore his ACL on his pre-restricted free agent year. They didn't tender him, but they basically signed him to a like deal. Wait, or did they tender him? Oh, I don't remember. It was one of the two, but it happened to Jerron Brown too. But the thing with Gardeck that sucks is that he's not going to be able to do anything till about midseason.
Yeah, and so that's the bugaboo with him. And so you kind of look at it and. From a pure need standpoint, like you said, it's really, I mean, on this team, it's really two positions. It's corner.
It's corner.
I will say it's probably three positions. It's you need wide receivers. You probably need a running back, like we talked about. And then you need help. And then you need lots of cornerback help.
Oh, here's the other thing. You literally have a need at both kicking positions. No punter and no kicker. I mean, you've got Brett Maher. I don't know if you can count it, but I hope he's not the plan for 2021. But you don't have a punter, and you don't know exactly. It's not like you count on Zane Gonzalez. You know, maybe Zane Gonzalez comes back. I don't think they pay him three in it. You know, I don't think you pay him $3 million next year unless it's an unguaranteed type deal. But they don't have, like, they have a young unproven kicker under contract and have no punter, so that's definitely
that's always interesting when you go into the offseason with no kicking game in place. But like I said, I mean, it's a long conversation to have, but they haven't done a great job of setting themselves up for this season, which, you know, the cynic in me says, well, this is, you know, on the GM, but it also makes me wonder if there is maybe a long term, or they're looking at this as a long term thing of, well, we knew we were going to turn over in 2020. We had really 2 years of friendly contract for Kyler left. And you kind of move forward with that ideal.
Cut on X on the Rise of Sierra podcast, the best of Cardinals talk of the moment. We'll bounce back with something that we'll talk about a little bit. We know of two potential moves on the coaching staff. What does it mean? That's Cut on X on the Rise of Sierra. back on the Rise Up C-Red podcast, the best of Cardinals talk on the web. There are going to be some changes on the coaching staff if these are as reported. Now, I will say, the Cardinals have played a little more coy than did last year. They didn't make any announcements about coaching changes, but some sleuthy reporting done by a number of people in the media here locally noticed, just checking the coaching roster after the season, Noah's guys were gone. The Cardinals don't announce firings or letting goes. They do announce changes. Now, they do additions or promotions, and we hear these two reports. One, that David Rye, receiver coach, who is, interestingly enough, has a connection to Cliff Kingsbury dating back to 2013. Now, Rye had worked in Green Bay as well, where Tom Clement came from. But Tom Clement, who is basically their offensive coordinator without being an offensive coordinator, he was basically the lead offensive coach, passing game coordinator, quarterback's coach, has reportedly retired, and David Rye has been released So however that means, whether they fired him or he was released from his deal to take another job somewhere else, whatever that means they don't have a receivers coach. They don't have their main quarterback's coach, and Cam Turner is supposedly going to take over as quarterback's coach. But that obviously now leaves a void at receiver's coach and also kind of opens the door to a potential offensive coordinator. Now, we know that this offensive – if there is an offensive coordinator by name, he won't be a play caller. It will be sort of, to Bruce Arians, what he did – you know, Harold Goodwin, who was basically an O-line coach that had the name of offensive coordinators. Because, I mean, it's interesting to see what happens with that. I had a guy write about some potential offensive coordinator guys. I don't know what to expect in terms of that. I don't even know if Cliff would go the route of, say, Anthony Lynn, like you suggested, might be a fit in terms of game management, because Cliff's going to call plays. That's his thing. You got to find a guy that can mesh with that, or I either agree with or can balance that out and not be really against that philosophy. Or you could go all in with a guy from college that Cliff would know to help him further. So what direction do you think happens? Do you think he actually hires an offensive coordinator? Sean McVay finally did it this past year when he had the right guy come up. Do you think that the Cardinals end up actually having a guy that's named offensive coordinator this year?
You know, I don't know. I kind of tweeted about it today when the Seahawks fired Brian Schottenheimer. I mean, you look at the development of Russell Wilson as a passer under Schottenheimer the last 3 years, and you say, okay, I mean, could he help as, you know, the passing game coordinator / quarterback coach for the Cardinals? I mean, you would think he would be able to help a little bit with what he did for Russell Wilson. I'm not sure. Like you, I'm not sure exactly what role Cliff is looking for from this. You know, how much help he's truly looking for. So that's kind of the question: is what is Cliff looking for, and what's he willing to do?
So, you know, it's going to be interesting to see that moving forward. I'm kind of interesting to see when things come out. Was Rye the fall guy? Was it a lack of performance that led to his dismissal, especially with his connection? Now, because that's interesting, because if Clement leaves and Rye leaves, that means both of those Green Bay connections, because Rye not only had ties to Cliff, he also had ties to Clement. Interesting to see the direction they go there. And more importantly, does a new receivers coach make a difference in the production and development of these receivers in 2021?
Yeah, and it's interesting because you look at the names Rye has coached, and there's some huge names in there. You know, obviously, like you said, his time with the Green Bay Packers, you know, Davante Adams and the like, but it just didn't seem like from a developmental standpoint, he did a good job. So, like you said, is he going to be the fall guy for whatever the situation is with Cliff, or was there an actual kind of issue with developing guys?
Cardo next on the Rise of Sea Red podcast, the best hour of Cardo's talk on the web. Let's move to the final topic. It's going to be a couple of things. So we'll look at some of the names that the Cardinals have signed to futures deals. Any names on there worth noting? And also, let's react to what we saw in the national championship game, Alabama-Ohio State. That's coming next on Rise of Sea Red. Back on the Rise of Sea Red podcast, the best hour of Cardinals talk on the web. And let's look at the Cardinals have signed 20 players to futures deals. 20. That's kind of the norm. As you look at the names, let me pull those up. There weren't many that stood out, but a couple of them are kind of interesting. Who are the names for the players that stood out to you as guys they added? Obviously, there was a bunch of practice squad guys.
I mean, you look at just the names that they added, and you see that it's really like you guys, you know, like we kind of talked about at the beginning, just filling out the roster and kind of getting guys, maybe a longer look of guys that they like. A couple of the guys, obviously, Michael Dogby is back, A.J. Richardson, Reggie Walker. I like JoJo Ward and Chase Whitaker played a little bit. He struggled, but Ian Bunting was an interesting guy that they brought in. Obviously, I'm interested to see. You know, he's a size kind of tight end. So do they see him as a potential guy like Dan Arnold, or do they see him more as a blocking type of guy? And then the final five guys that they brought in, the one guy that caught my eye, gosh, I gotta look at his name.
Sharif Miller was the guy that stood out to me simply because he was a name that came up as a pass rusher coming out of the draft, and just it never panned out in Philadelphia. Although looking at his physical profile, the Cardinals might be a better fit playing in a 3-4. There's a little bit of potential there, I think. Not that you can get too excited over a day three pick that hasn't done anything. He was productive in college.
Yeah, and the guy I was thinking of was David Perry, the guy that played with the Vikings. He's played for a while. And he's been around for a while in the league, was on the Patriots practice squad. He's put up some numbers in the NFL, including starting 32 games with the Indianapolis Colts. Yeah. So I mean, he's a guy that looks like the type that could make the roster and obviously we're not talking about, like you said, these are guys that you're kind of throwing Hail Marys for, but Perry looks like a type of guy that could potentially make the roster and be a contributor.
A guy to watch, and this is just a hunch, because he's a guy they brought in training camp. I'm not saying he's going to be a starter, but a guy that could be a rotation, or at least a depth guy, and that would be Coda Martin, a guy they claimed off of, that they signed off of the Chargers. He was... And I think I'm okay to talk about this now. During training camp, he got reps on the second team, and it seemed, and he was on the practice squad all season. You know, they like guys like that, whether they see with a little bit of potential on the interior, like they did with Justin Murray. He's a guy you might see filling a depth role. Super fast guy. He's really small, but the running back that they brought in, they had him on the Oprasa squad earlier. You've got Khalfani Muhammad. He's little and he is fast as well. And you look at some of the other guys that they've got on here. Jojo Ward is obviously Evan Weaver, Michael Dogby. You like to see them develop and fill roles. There's a couple of neat stories in there, but yeah. Then you've got the kicker, obviously, Brett Maher, that they've added. So, yeah,
and he really struggled with the Cowboys, right?
He got some leg. It's going to be interesting to see because, you know, when they brought in Zane, he'd had some struggles, and, you know, the special teams coach Jeff Rogers, he believed in him, and it paid off at least for a season and a half. But I guess he's kicking his thing. It's rough.
Yeah, right. Exactly. It's tough. I mean, there's a reason the guys that do it stick around for longer than most people stay at one job.
Yeah. Let's talk about now the championship game. So Alabama, Ohio State, there's a lot of guys to get really excited about. And the Cardinals picking number 16 in the draft. You know, you have to figure with the numbers that Devontae Smith put up, is there any chance that he's going to be there for the Cardinals? I mean, the size, maybe.
Only if teams get really worried about that. other than that, no. I mean, there's just no way. He's one of the cleanest receiver prospects I can remember in the last, you know, 10 years. You just look at his movement ability is just otherworldly, but he's a clean route runner, which makes him, you know, really difficult to cover. You know, that's the one thing though, is will teams be nervous? Because I don't think scared is the right word, but will they be nervous about his size? I mean, he is 170 pounds at 6'1". That's a really lean body type. He's, you know, obviously he got injured in the game. I don't think it's anything serious. So, but that's, I just don't see any way he's available at 16. I think you can move up into the top 10, probably top 7. But the other problem is the positions the Cardinals need the most at 16 are positions that a lot of the teams in front of them need. let's take Jacksonville off the board. The Jets need wide receivers. The Dolphins need wide receivers. The Falcons, depending on what's going on with Julio, could need a wide receiver. The Bengals could use a wide receiver. The Eagles and the Lions desperately need wide receivers. The Panthers could be losing two wide receivers, you know, and then you get to the Broncos. Okay, so maybe the Broncos don't need a wide receiver. That's six teams in the top 10 that need wide receivers. Then you look at the cornerbacks, the other kind of position, with Patrick Surtain probably being one of the top two or three guys. A ton of teams need corners. And so is he a guy that's going to be available when it gets to that point? I think the two guys on Bama, and maybe three if you like the defensive lineman Barmore, who had a really good game, that could be available. One is Jalen Waddle. Waddle's going to be interesting because I think he's actually a better player than Henry Ruggs was coming out. And Ruggs went 12 or 13 last year, I think it was. I know he went to Las Vegas. I just don't know exactly where he went to Las Vegas. So I think he's better than Ruggs. He's almost as fast, if not as fast as Ruggs, which is incredible. So that'll be, you know, something to watch. And then everybody's least favorite first round pick now, apparently, running back, but Najee Harris, you know, talking with some guys, and we were, you know, kind of comparing Najee's game, and the guy that he reminds me of the most when he runs is Le'Veon Bell. And that prime Le'Veon Bell, where he's got kind of that patience and he's got the athleticism out of the backfield, catching the ball. He's just a true kind of three down back. Right now, he's the guy I've been looking at because, and I just say this because I'm not sure if drafting the fourth wide receiver or the fourth corner, the two, you know, biggest need positions that we talked about going into this is the way to go. There's going to be some offensive linemen. I'm not sure what everybody thinks of the kid out of USC. I'm not even going to like pretend to try to pronounce his name. I'll learn it if I have to. I like the kid out of Texas, but I don't know if he can play on the inside. And I don't know if you're going to, draft a tackle. so, you know, it really kind of comes down to who falls to Arizona. If Surtain, you know, just talking about from that game, obviously, if Surtain falls, I think he's an easy selection. He fits kind of what Vance wants to do, and he's got the physicality that Vance has kind of lacked, let's be completely honest, at the position since he took over. Nothing that he can control. And so, you know, I think they'd be a good fit. Waddle, sign me up. And then, you know, like I said, I think Najee Harris. On the Ohio State side, I'm a big fan of Wyatt Davis. He didn't have the best game yesterday, but he also was injured. And then he struggled a little bit with against Barmore, who's come on strong lately. Barmore kind of reminds me a little bit of Stephon Tuitt, the kid out of Notre Dame who's played really well for Pittsburgh. I don't think he's a guy that's going to be kind of like, he's not going to be the, you know, 8 to 10 sack a year type of guy early in his career, but I think he's got the goods to be a potential kind of Pro Bowl type of guy as his career develops. I mean, you look at Tua in Pittsburgh, and you know, he had one sack as a rookie, and then he kind of middled around at 5 sacks a season, but then he had 11 this year in year 7 of his career. So it's like, you know, sometimes it takes a little bit for these guys to develop, even these Bama prospects who seemingly look like they're ready to be world beaters on day one.
And with that, we will end this edition of the Rise Up Sea Red podcast. We will talk again next week. This will go more in depth in terms of free agents and needs that the Cardinals might have. And then we can start a little bit more about the draft. This will be a fun time moving forward, a little more playoffs. But as we wrap up this edition of the show, that's Seth Cox. I'm Jess Root. Thanks for listening as always. Go Cardinals. We'll be back again next week.
Thanks for listening to the latest edition of the Rise Up Sea Red podcast. Listen to previous episodes and subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher Radio, Audioboom, or many other podcast platforms so shows are delivered directly to your mobile device. Please give the show a 5-star rating and always support the sponsors who support the show. We'll be back soon for the best hour of Cardinals talk on the web. Rise up, Red Sea, be Red Sea Red, and of course, Rise Up, Sea Red. Whoa!